Welcome to another riveting and cheesy episode of Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. I'm your host, Ann Saxelby, and our show today has been sponsored by Fairway, like no other market, and is being produced and engineered by Nat Wiener. Heritage Radio Network, for those of you who haven't been, is located in the backyard of Roberta's Pizzeria, best pizza and fried chicken in town, at 261 Moore Street in Bushwick, Brooklyn. So stop on by anytime and have a pie or two while, you know, watching weirdos like us back out here in the shipping container recording radio shows. It's way more fun than just eating pizza and, you know, staring at a flat screen. So my guest today is none other than the world famous Steve Jenkins, Fairway Market's own cheese guru and one of my own personal cheese heroes. Steve and I are going to discuss the idea of cheese idioms, something that I was sort of absolutely tickled by when he suggested it. I'm a huge dork, admittedly. I love language and sort of the intersection of language and food, and think that to talk about idioms in terms of tastes and archetypes of different styles of cheeses is really, really fun. So thanks for being on the show, Steve.
Thanks for letting me invite myself.
Absolutely, no problem. When I got that email, I was like, "Really? You would hang out with me and be in my show?"
I'm here because I'm so impressed with what you've done in such a short time. I'm here because I love coming to Roberta's. I mean, this is like the 87th time I've come here. I love being out here, and the combination of getting to talk to you and be here at Roberta's is like as fun as things can get.
Oh, man. Well,
but I mean, I'm
blushing.
I'm a Fairway guy, but it sounds a little crass that we're sponsoring the show. It sounds like, yeah, well, we'll sponsor your show, but you got to have me on. But that's not the way it works.
It's not the way it works. The sponsors, in fact, at Heritage Radio are randomly rotated. It's like the bingo lotto thing. You know, the bubble balls, and they would come out and announce the numbers. We just got Fairway.
It's totally egalitarian, and no rhyme or reason. But I got my outfit to give these guys money because I love what they do. And you young people like talking to old guys that have been doing this for so long. So I said, what the heck? I'm here, man. I love being here.
I don't see any old guys in this room.
Yeah, right.
Come on. Well, there's that cat. Henry looks like he might be a little bit old. But, well, so I have to start by, you know, telling you a ridiculous story. I have to confess, I have a copy of your book, The Cheese Primer, actually here, but it's in this. It's in the recording studio with Nat. And it was given to me on my very first day on the job at Murray's back in 2003. There was this manager named Everett Presley in the first day I was there.
Wow, what a great name.
Yeah, such a good name. And so he gave me a copy of your book, and I remember taking it out on my lunch break to Father Demo Square, which is a kind of seedy little triangular park. And just flipping through it, eating a slice of pizza and thinking like, oh my God, there is so much to know.
Well, but you were already an idiot savant when you got to Murray's, right?
Well, no, I just knew I liked eating cheese a lot and figured that I could like fudge my way through the rest, you know, and hopefully by eating my weight in samples could begin to describe what cheese is like to other
people. I think
people
of Ann Saxelby as just being born really smart and knowing all this stuff, you know, from the get-go. You're telling me that when you were down there, you didn't really know all the stuff you know now.
I knew nothing.
Really?
Yeah. No, absolutely nothing. My favorite cheese, in fact, and maybe I don't want to sound like a snob, but my favorite cheese on the first day I remember was fromage dauphinois, which is this kind of like...
Yeah, like a factory cheese. It's no big deal.
Yeah, factory cheese. It's like brie, but they kind of make it look like Carvel or something. It's kind of fancy. Kind of more ice creamy than brie.
You are a snob.
Yeah, I know. I like Carvel and Dairy Queen and all the rest of it. But, well, so after I got your book, I kept it on my bedside table. And instead of, you know, reading like whatever else I would read before I would go to bed, I would pick like a region or a couple cheeses. And
well, heck, that's how you're supposed to do your whole life. Everybody out there, find the book that teaches you stuff and stick with it until you learn it all. That's the only way you can be the best.
Absolutely. So yeah, instead of like, you know, when I would go to sleep, instead of having like sugar plum fairies or whatever else, I had like little cheese goblins and Italian shepherds, you know, dancing around in my head.
That's the way it's supposed to be.
So thank you for writing that awesome book.
Well, I can't believe that you didn't already know all that stuff.
No, I really knew nothing. I knew that I liked cheese and wine. And I was like, well, I don't want to pay to go to school to learn it. So yeah. I figure I'll just get jobs where I get Smart. To be around people who love it. And hopefully...
That's how it's done.
Yeah.
Find something that nobody else is doing much of and decide you're going to learn everything there is to know about it and do it. That's how you get happy.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
Like these guys at Roberta's. They've built this place from, you know... an old abandoned, warehouse.
Yeah. I've been here, I tell you, so many times, and it's just the joy of my life to come to Roberta's. This is the coolest joint.
In
there
town.
Is.
Yeah. Yeah. And where do you live? Are you?
I'm Upper West Sider for 100 years.
Awesome.
Yeah. I mean, we get around, but, you know, my wife and I have raised kids up there. But, you know, we get around. We come to BAM and we come to St. Anne's. For everything that's at St. Anne's, we're there.
Okay.
For everything that's at BAM, we're there, you know. So we get around.
Definitely.
I saw Richard Foreman's play with Willem Dafoe a couple of nights ago.
Wow.
I've aged out of Richard Foreman. I can't take it anymore.
I've never been to one of his plays, but I went to art school at NYU. That's kind of what led me to cheese, I guess.
Yeah.
I figured for me, cheese was art that people
Definitely.
Could eat.
It's very artsy.
And
yeah.
not... pretentious.
Yeah, but
like
we're Wooster Project freaks for 100 years. We've my wife and I've always been Wooster Project people.
Mm-hmm.
And Willem was, you know, significant with Elizabeth LeCompte, and they broke up, and no more Willem Dafoe in Wooster Group. So he does a lot of still experimental theater, and he certainly has worked with Richard Foreman before. But Wooster Group is the most brilliant thing that ever walked. On the earth. It was every most brilliant outfit that's ever been in the theater ever. And if you move away from Wooster Group, it's just not going to be as coherent and extraordinary as anything else. And, you know, Richard Foreman's just not my cup of tea. It's just too whacked out. And Willem Dafoe.
It's kind of, tell us about it. It's kind of weird, right? It's kind of like lots of random sounds and noises and screaming. And
it's not everybody's cup of tea, but it's just, for me to sit here and pass judgment on that kind of work is ridiculous. But I'm a Wooster Group person, not a Richard Foreman person.
Well,
and I'm an Elizabeth LeCompte person. I'm not a Willem Dafoe person. And to each his own.
Yeah, yeah.
It's like Fromage Dauphinois or Jarlsberg. It's your choice.
Yeah.
Doesn't mean it's a bad choice. It just may not be as informed a choice or as tasteful a choice. It's nobody
or
can
as
judge.
Like, you know, maybe won't leave you thinking about it for that much long after you eat it, or it might
right.
leave you, you know, with like a little resonating, you know.
That's the whole deal, is
echoes.
You want to be thinking about it after you've tasted it or after you've seen the theater group or whatever. You know, if you're thinking
yeah.
about it, that means that it was something special.
Now, you were in theater yourself before you got into cheese, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So how did that transition happen for you?
Well, I got plenty of roles back in the 70s. I was okay. I did soaps and got money for it. And I did
nice.
A few commercials and got money for it, but not enough. And I didn't like auditioning, and I didn't like the material. I didn't like most of the theater. I didn't like the directors that I had, and I didn't like anything about the theater world. I was not happy. It just was not for me. I had devoted myself to the literature for all those, you know, 4, 5, 6 years that a young man or a young woman will do. And you think this is going to be my métier is theater and the literature of the theater and the business of Stanislavski, and who said an actor's business is knowing everything there is to know about everything. And that kind of theory made sense to me because I wanted to know everything there was to know about everything, but I didn't like the literature, and I didn't like the directors, and I didn't like auditioning, and I didn't like standing around in line, and I didn't like anything about it. So I got a job where I could pursue knowing everything there is to know about everything, but not having to put up with directors and other actors and bad scripts and all of that.
You're nonsense. Your own show. The cheese, yeah, the cheese program
counter,
at Fairway.
If you get a counter for whatever foodstuff you're selling, you got your own show.
Yes, you do.
I fell into having my own venue where if it made sense to me, I was going to make it make sense to you. It happened to be cheese. But that was just because I needed a job. But as I say, Stanislavski said, an actor's business is to know everything there is to know about everything, or you can't be as good an actor as you're supposed to be.
So for you, you know, having your own show behind the cheese counter, then it totally makes sense, you know, in reading your book, how much to heart you took that comment. Because when you go through the cheeses, it's not just like, oh, this cheese tastes like blah, blah, blah. Or this cheese is made in like this part of France. It's like it begins with like the etymology of the cheese. Like, where did the name come from?
Why did they call it that?
Yeah.
What did that mean? And when did that happen? And it turns out it was really pretty much an issue of where they were.
Yeah.
Most of those names came from where they were. And I was always knocked out by that. And I was always offended by all this stuff from our company, our country, United States, where we would give names to things that was just didn't make any sense at all and didn't pay any respect at all to that item that was being named. Whereas the Europeans, they'd name it after the closest town.
Or, and this is where I like the sort of language part and the part that I think is so brilliant about your book, and I don't have it right in front of me, so I can't say it as well as I want to, but Reblochon, which is one of the more famous cheeses in
France. An exception to the rule.
Yeah, was an exception to the rule, and that it was named after a verb, right?
Named after a slang verb that meant to milk again and had nothing to do with anything in Savoie or any village that was close to Reblochon, because it predated any of those settlements. They were always re-milking those cattle. They were always milking again the cattle to pay a tithe or some kind of rent or some kind of tax to the powers that be in that neighborhood of Savoie, which was all forests, and very few of those forests were cleared for pasture land. The ones that were cleared for pasture land had animals on them that were giving milk. But whoever ran the forest was the boss. And if you had that pasture, you had to pay some money to that guy to enable your animals to live. Mm-hmm. So that you could survive. So to reblocher was to milk again, because you would say, ah, how are you? It's good to see you. Here's the milk that I owe you for the rent. And you'd give him the milk.
Steve's making milking motions. Making everyone can picture that right now.
and the guy goes, oh, that's great. And he goes away. And then you continue to milk. You made him think that the cow or the sheep or the goat was finished. But they weren't. You just made him think that they were. And then he'd go away. And then you would finish the milking. And the milk that you would get from having made that lady animal stop becomes very rich when you begin to milk her again. It's like when you're peeing and you stop peeing and you want to pee again and you pee again. It just feels so good. It's the same thing with a lactating female sheep or goat or cow when you begin to milk her again. And she gives the richest milk at that time in the reblocher. So the cheese that you make from that is richer and creamier and more flavorful than the milk that you just gave to the tax man. And that's where that name came from. And it just goes back beyond when it was Savoie, beyond when it was Savoie was part of Piedmont, beyond there was any duke there. Just back when folks ran different neighborhoods of that beautiful part of the Alps.
Yeah.
And the guys that controlled the trees were the Gruyères. That's really? Where the word Gruyère came from.
I didn't know that.
So Gruyère is not the name of a town. Well, it is the name of a town all over. There's one in Valais, and there's one in Schwitz. There's one in Savoie, and there's one in Franche-Comté. There's all these places named Gruyère. But Gruyère came from the people that ran the forests.
Wow.
The people that controlled the trees were the people that had the puissance, had the power, because logs, trees were made to burn, to make fire. And if you had fire, you were the recipient of like the nuclear plant, the nuclear fuel.
And Gruyere was traditionally made over fire in a copper vat.
Had to cook the curd.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I was thinking a lot about this. And so in a lot of ways, the cheeses of Europe are a lot like the evolution of language in that they happened, you know, like the little patois and the little dialect, the cheeses happened in small regions over many, many years because of a myriad of factors, you know.
Trial and error.
Trial and error, yeah, but also, you know, it depended on political stuff, you know, like what kind of taxes they had to pay. It depended you know, like military stuff? Like, were they being invaded by people? Were they exposed to other cultures, or was it very insular?
That's why Sardinia is so amazing. All those cheesemakers that are there are all inland. You know, there's nobody on the coast. The pastures are the same on the coast, but they all had to be inland because everybody that came by Sardinia would raid it and take it over. The only way you could be safe was inland. So that whole culture is very much the same as Savoie, where you're up in the mountains to be safe and you're deep in the forest to be safe from everybody's trying to rip you off and take control of everything. So this whole thing of cheese making that predates villages and words, it was all about being safe.
Yeah. And having that thing, that food that was going to sustain you and your family.
Because you couldn't drink all that milk at once because it would spoil. So you had to figure out how to preserve some of that milk that you had. That was your gold. That was your lucre. So you learned by trial and error how to curd it up so that it would last for weeks and months and or years.
Well, so I think we have to take a quick break, but I think it's a perfect time to do it because when we come back, maybe we can talk a little bit about the American phenomenon of naming their cheeses weird random things and how that really makes sense with all the stuff we're just talking about. So we will be right back on Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network. So welcome back to Cutting the Curd on the Heritage Radio Network, sponsored by Fairway Market. And Steve is in no way, shape, or form behind that tonight. It's a random lottery of sponsors. And Fairway is one of the original cheese counters in New York City. And so I think it's very appropriate that they are helping us out with the show. So Steve and I were just talking about the cheeses of Europe and how they developed stylistically, how the names evolved from the place, but also from how the cheeses were made. And he made a comment back in the beginning of the show about American cheeses and how they kind of bugged him. Did you say they bugged you, or am I just inferring that?
Well, I think that's mostly a product of the fact that I'm just a geezer.
I'm an old lady at heart too, so yeah, these young people coming in here and making up cheese names like Constant Bliss and like Bloomsday and like Buck Hill Sunshine and God, I could go on and
Four
on.
Four Corners.
Hey, that's the name of the town, Heartland Four Corners. But so I think it's very interesting, this American cheese making tradition that we have, which, you know, is 20 years old or 30 years old, maybe, compared with a European tradition that's hundreds of years old. And in the beginning, you know, back in like the 60s and 70s, when people were really starting to make, you know, sort of more handmade cheeses here, a lot of times, you know, language is something that allows us to form a frame around things. It lets us put things into buckets and categories and identify where they come from. And so I think in the beginning, Americans were naming their cheeses feta and gouda and valençay and other French names or Dutch names or whatever names, because that's the only way that people would have any frame of reference for what they were talking about.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Feta is an exception, like reblochon. Feta just means a hunk as big as your head. It just means slice. And it was only a couple of years ago that in the middle of the night, the Greeks internationally trademarked the name feta so that no other country or company in another country other than Greece could legally call their cheese feta, which is okay with me in principle or in practice, in that, yeah, I mean, if you are the progenitor and the originator of a certain substance, in this case a cheese, you ought to have some rights to it. But, you know, where do you draw the line? The Cypriots did the same thing with halloumi, which is a place name and deserves to be name controlled for Cypriots. But it doesn't address the fact that for quite a few decades, other countries and businesses in other countries have been making the exact same, self-same recipe of a cheese that they refer to as halloumi. Suddenly, from one night to the next, and literally in the night they did this, they internationally trademarked halloumi the same way the Greeks did feta. You can't call it halloumi anymore. So that's why I say to Ann Saxelby, I like the notion of naming your cheese after the closest village that has a Wawa or a 7-Eleven or something that you can put your finger on and say, this is Valençay, this is Chavignol, or this is
Libertyville. In my case, I grew up in Libertyville.
Libertyville.
That does not have much
called Libertyville.
It would have to have like blueberries and strawberries in it or something.
You know, there's Albertville in Franche-Comté, but they don't call Comté Albertville, but they call it Comté after the count
after the region
that was in that region. So, you know, Libertyville.
Yeah, it doesn't have much of a ring to it.
What county was it in?
Lake County.
That's not even a good name either.
No. You got to, like, but in the Northeast, they've got some good little names.
Well, they've got terrific names. Like, Indian names.
Yeah.
Iroquois.
Yeah, Windermere.
Sure.
What, a Jasper Hill cheese named after a little lake.
That's splendid.
Constant Bliss is actually, that's named after a guy who was
love that name, though.
Killed in battle.
Really?
A Revolutionary War soldier.
That. Really?
Yeah. Constant Bliss. There's a little monument in the middle of Greensboro, Vermont.
Wow.
And it's to Constant Bliss and his compatriot Moses Sleeper, who both killed by Indians way back when.
Would they have been Iroquois or Mohawks?
Oh.
Had to be one of those tribes.
Yeah, I don't know.
But those are splendid names.
Yeah. And so I feel like American cheesemakers are starting to get it. They're starting to feel less insecure about their cheesemaking identities and starting to seek out ways to make their cheeses, you know, name place specific.
As opposed to that Wisconsin outfit, the owner of which is a really good friend of mine, Errico Arricchio. You know, he comes from the great Arricchio family that made
provolone.
The great provolone.
Yeah.
And he's the side of the family that moved to Wisconsin. I'm making a really great story a little bit too long, but
yeah.
I would say to Errico, why did you move here? And he told me the first time I'd ever heard that from any European. He said that in the United States, the pastures are better, the animals are better, the business climate is better, the opportunity is better. And this was like the first day I ever realized that, you know, the United States is a pretty cool place to be an artisan, to do something like making cheese. If I'm going to hear this from the scion of the most famous cheesemaking family in Europe, that we've got better animals and better soil and better herbage that comes out of that soil and a better business climate, then, you know, that's not too darn bad. So anyway.
And that was a while ago, though, right? When did he come over here?
Probably, he told me that probably 10 years ago.
Wow.
That's a long time for us.
And I mean, yeah, it's a long time for us. And it's also pretty visionary for someone from Italy to see past, you know, the corn and soybeans or whatever it is that we're known for, you know, and get into those little niches of pasture land in Wisconsin and say, hey, this is it.
And find out what all those little species of clover are that grow, those little gentians and all of those little things that have esters that find their way through the mammal lactation into the milk and give character to that milk. And he found out that there's all kinds of little wild things that grow that his cows consume. And then the girls make it come through the mammal lactation and into the milk. That's fabulous. But what I wanted to tell you is, Errico named his cheese that's like Parmesan something just preposterous to get the vegetarian market because he used vegetable rennet in it, and it ended up sounding like a female body part. It was like Vegano, and he actually called it that. And of course, the Consorzio for Parmigiano-Reggiano jumped all over his case and said, you can't call this cheese that.
They are like the secret police.
Yes.
The Consorzio for Parmigiano.
Well, Yes, they are, but they're also the biggest hypocrites that ever walked the earth. I mean, they're marketing their cheese now in shavings and sticks, Parmigiano Reggiano, and they're allowing it to happen. They should be ashamed of themselves.
I remember when I was at Murray's, the Consorzio came through. I think it was during the fancy food show or something like that. And we had this basket of rinds that we would sell to people for soup and whatever else.
Dogs,
exactly. And they were mad. They were pissed because...
You never told me that. They gave a beef because you had a basket of rinds.
We have a basket of... No, but because the Grana Padano rinds were mixed in with the Parmigiano rinds, and they were all labeled Parmigiano rinds. And I thought to myself, wow. I was like, I understand about the cheese, but, you know, that's taking it a bit too far.
That's the pits, those people. So they threw big beef about Veggiano and took him to court, and they can't call it that anymore. But that's a perfect example of a European, I mean, that's 180 degrees.
I mean, Erico should have just paid them to say that, hey, the name was really bad. They should change it, you know, forget the legal fees.
I wasn't using my head that night. Yeah. It's just bad taste. Yeah. But isn't that funny that a European would come here and make some phony baloney name like that and have to litigate it and everything when, you know, they're the people that originally would give things the right name. Cheese from Parma and from Reggio, two important cities in Emilia-Romagna, where in between were all the pastures where the great grating cheese that we know as Parmesan came from because of Parma and Reggio. Parmigiano Reggiano. And that's how Anne Saxelby and I think cheeses ought to be named, is if you can't find a locale, find Constant Bliss. I mean, that's the most beautiful name I've ever heard.
Yeah, yeah.
Wouldn't you say? I mean, it's really nice.
It's really nice. A lot of those old Yankee names were very nice. Actually, there's also Consider Bardwell Farm.
Consider Bardwell drives me crazy. That's the prettiest name.
Yeah. Consider Stebbins Bardwell.
That is so pretty.
What's his name?
Was that a woman?
No, man.
Constant and Consider were both men.
Yeah.
Wouldn't you have thought that a mom and dad would have named their daughter those two names, not a boy?
Yeah.
I'm really surprised to hear that.
It's, I don't know, maybe it's some of those like Yankee values, you know? It's kind of like honor and rigor and
integrity.
Well, yeah,
but the chastity, you know, and the purity and those are always women, little baby girls.
That's
names.
True. If they named their sons Chastity, they wouldn't probably get very far.
Or Veggiano.
Or Veggiano.
But my favorite ones are French. I mean, I really earned my stripes by going down every single little road in every single region of France and just marveling over all the sweet names that are all places for all these cheeses that Anne Saxelby and me have been selling all these years. I mean, Pouligny-Saint-Pierre, a little teeny village.
I made Pouligny-Saint-Pierre. Really? I lived in the Loire Valley for a while.
Oh,
and made Pouligny-Saint-Pierre, Saint-Maur, and Seltzer-Cher.
Saint-Maur. Now, that's something interesting that I don't know that our listeners care about or are interested in. But
you know, we care about it. So
I care so deeply about it. I mean, Saint-Maur is the great log-shaped goat cheese that comes from south of Tours, which is the region known as Touraine, which is in central France. And the great log of goat cheese with a piece of straw down the middle is named after a little village south of Tours that's called Saint-Maur. But what's interesting to me about it is that Saint has an E on the end of it. That means it's a female saint.
Mm-hmm.
So way back when, there was a woman whose name was Maur. And that word comes from M-O-O-R. This is M-A-U-R-E, Saint-Maur. But it came from the Moors that were there back in 400 B.C., when the Arabs were in that part of what we knew then as Gaul, and there was some woman who was either born and raised in Islam or became converted to Christianity before 400 AD, not BC, in 400 AD. And D.H. Lawrence wrote a little novella about Saint-Maur.
About Saint-Maur, the cheese or the woman?
A horse.
A horse?
Yeah, Saint-Maur was a horse.
Okay.
But anyway, that's a very lovely thing to call a cheese, Saint-Maur.
That is absolutely beautiful. Well, and it, I feel like a lot of what, that's very interesting, because a lot of what I taste in European cheeses, and I don't get to taste enough of them lately because, you know, I only sell American stuff, but you really taste kind of like layers and like a patina and, you know, just kind of a, this incredible, I don't know, sort of, it's like a filtering, you know, when you have the cheese in your mouth, it kind of filters through all these different little minutiae and nuances of flavor. And with some American cheeses, I don't get that quite as much yet. You know what I mean? They're good cheeses. They're solid.
You think it's the milk or the cheese making? I think it's the cheese making.
I think it's both. I think it's everything. It's like that language that we were talking about. You know what I mean? It's because of all of those years of building up all those little experiences from the goats being in that region for a certain area, or for goat, mm-hmm. the goats being in the region for a certain reason. And
they're in the region because of the Moors from 400 AD.
Exactly. And so it has this kind of just like grand culture behind it, no pun intended, that is, you know,
culture.
Just kind of lacking.
I get it.
You know, yeah. I can't help myself. Cheese lends itself to a million stupid puns. But so I feel like our cheesemakers are getting that now. Like the cheeses are starting to taste more deep and more sort of profound like that. But that is a difference, you know?
Profound is being where you made Pouligny Saint-Pierre, where there are hummingbirds and there's bees and there's songbirds. You think they've eaten every bird that flew over, but they haven't. It's a lush part of Europe where all of these esters and all of these pollens are floating around, and they affect things that grow that these animals eat, and they produce this milk that's magical. And usually the person making the cheese has done it for generations, and so there's something magical with that.
Yeah, well, we have, unfortunately, a short time left, but in that short time, maybe you can just explain, you know, real quick, the word esters. I mean, if we're talking about language, esters has always been a word that I love, but that I haven't quite been able to put my finger on if somebody asked me how to define it. So what would you say about esters?
I'd say an ester is the same thing that makes a young red wine tannic and sort of bitter. I would say ester is that rusty thing that's in a species of mountain gentian, a purple wildflower that a cow in Franche-Comté eats near the village of Jex, and her milk has that ester within it, and that cheesemaker appreciates that. And when that cheesemaker makes that blue de Jex, she knows that she doesn't have to pierce that blue cheese because that ester is in that cheese. It's going to feed those bacteria, and they're going to multiply and blue out and form that, make that cheese be a blue de Jex. An ester is a magical living substance that exists in things that live that you can't really rub onto the back of your hand, but they're going to be there if your animals eat it and then you milk them.
It's like a little primordial flavor.
It's like
just a little primordial stew.
And the only evidence of it is when you smell a flower. That's its ester. But the ester still is within that blossom, and it's going to have to get crunched up
and digested
into you to manifest itself.
And that, well, I mean, maybe that's a funny and fitting way to end it, is that, you know, when you taste a cheese, a lot of it is about smell. And oftentimes the hardest thing to do when you taste a cheese is put that smell into words, because
can't articulate a fragrance.
There's a feeling about it. You have some inkling of what it was, maybe like when you were 6 years old or something like that. But to actually find to describe it,
it's an atavar of a memory that you really never had.
Yeah, yeah.
You think you knew, but you don't really remember.
Can't quite get it. Yeah.
That's why you want to sit in it.
Sit in the cheese? I like that.
Yeah.
I like that.
You want to hatch that cheese.
Exactly. Exactly. Well, I think we're going to have to keep eating to, you know, discover more about it. That's the only way.
We're at Roberta's.
And your food's probably waiting at your table, so
I didn't come here for food. I came here to talk to you.
Well, hopefully you'll come back and be on the show again. This was awesome.
If you say so.
It was incredible to have Steve Jenkins on Cutting the Curd today. Join us in 2 weeks on the Heritage Radio Network.